This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory Anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions.
Well, hello. I am Sonia Rodriguez, and you are listening to Trial Lawyer Nation. Today on Trial Lawyer Nation, you are in for a real treat. We have a great guest speaker today, Michael Cowan. Michael, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Sonia. How are you doing? It's a little odd to be interviewed on my own podcast, but I had some listeners at the ATA symposium come up and suggest it. So here we are.
So I am excited to be able to do this because I feel like I know so much about you and what makes you tick. And it'll be a good opportunity for your listeners to get to know you better, too. Why don't we start with how you found yourself in the practice of personal injury trucking trial law?
That's a long story. So I'll start with personal injury and then I'll go to trucking. So when I was thinking about going to law school, the last thing in the world I would have been, thought I would have been, was a personal injury lawyer.
Why? Hold on. Why?
Well, you have to understand where I came from. So my dad was a small business owner. My uncle was the chief of staff for someone who's then a state representative, later became a state senator, who got elected on a tort reform platform. Oh. So my family didn't believe in lawsuits. You know, and I, in fact, had dinner before I started law school with my uncle and a man named Bill Summers, who founded an organization called Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse. And we all had dinner, and he was, you know, enlisting me to go out there and get the skills to help protect businesses that were getting sued.
How far did you go down that path?
Well, it's interesting because during, you know, I still wasn't planning on becoming a personal injury lawyer even when I graduated. I went and clerked on the Fifth Circuit. I got a job in big law. I was, you know, planning on being a corporate litigator, a securities litigator, which is where I started. But during law school, I needed jobs. I wanted money to, you know, go out to eat, buy beer, whatever else I wanted to do at the age of 21, 22. And I got part-time jobs for personal injury lawyers because they were hiring. And back then, minimum wage was $3.35 an hour. I had never made more than $3.35 an hour, except for when I waited tables.
You are dating yourself.
I am. And one job paid $10 an hour, and then another one paid $14 an hour. And so I was over the moon. And I found that when I did the work, I really liked the work. And then when I took torts, I amateured torts. I got the highest grade in my class in torts, and it all made sense to me. And when I understood the logic of it, and I understood that, you know, the one of the reasons we had non-economic damages is that that's how you get companies to be safe. It started making sense to me. And so, you know, I still wasn't planning on becoming a personal injury lawyer, but I was no longer vehemently opposed to the civil justice system by the time I got out of law school.
So I have a theory that the very, very best trial lawyers really do just love it. Like they love the work. And so I have a question for you about why or what you experienced back when you were a law student and a law clerk. What about that part-time job, those part-time jobs in the personal injury arena really called to you?
Honestly, I think a lot of it was the autonomy. Not to toot my own horn, but I was a pretty good researcher and writer. And so I could do good work. And for a personal injury law firm, I was responding to summary judgment motions. I did appellate briefs. I did real meaningful work for clients that actually got filed in court. Whereas in big law, like I would do a research memo that a mid-level associate would draft into a part of a motion that a senior level associate would assemble to a motion that the partner would then review and revise. And it you didn't feel like you had the same control over your craft. And so that to me was a huge difference. Frankly, whether a corporation has, you know, $1 billion or $1 billion, $1 million doesn't make a whole lot of difference to it. So you're not really changing lives very often when you're doing this corporate litigation. It's just, you know, it's just big companies fighting about money. So that was the other factor.
Yeah. So let's be completely frank. In our practice, there are not a lot of opportunities to really truly change lives, especially when you're a younger lawyer. We're working on smaller cases and maybe, you know, you're making somebody's life better and helping them recalibrate their finances for a little bit. Tell us how you were motivated to stick with the practice despite, you know, some challenging early years.
Oh, you mean once I got into personal injury?
Yeah.
There's a whole story about how I got in there. But yeah, it never occurred to me to quit. Once I got in, and I went through some real challenging times. I mean, I was two and a half, three years into personal injury litigation. I'd become a partner quickly, and my boss just quit with 3 weeks' notice and became a public defender. And I ended up with my own firm way before I was ready. I didn't have the experience. I didn't have the capital. I definitely had no idea how to run a business. But it never occurred to me to quit doing personal injury law. I did do some other kind of law aside from personal injury law to pay the bills. I got admitted in tax court and did some tax litigation. I did family law. I did some criminal defense. I did some business litigation. But personal injury law, once I got into it, was where my passion was. And we say we're not, you know, totally changing people's lives. But, you know, when you're making minimum wage and you get $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, that is a big change in your life. Now, it's not a permanent change. And when you're, how can I put it? If you're kind of treated like nothing your whole life and you have people that care about you and treat you well and you get, okay, your pain is worth something, I think that can be life-changing too. Just the message from society that you have value, the message from a law firm that you have value. So I've always felt like there was a purpose in it, but I just love it. I think that's the other thing. Like I love trying cases. I love the autonomy. I mean, if I had some insurance adjuster telling me how much I could work or what arguments to make, I couldn't do it.
So there's a competitiveness about you when it comes to suing big corporations. And, you know, one of your philosophies and our philosophy at the firm is that we want our clients to get the same legal representation as the major corporations. Do you think that comes from your stint in big law, your experience there, or is that deeper seated than that?
I think it's deeper seated than that. I've always, unfairness has always really bothered me. It bothered me a lot more when I was younger. I've learned to accept that the world isn't fair a little bit more, although I want to do what I can to change that in the ways where I have the power to change that. But it always did seem to me to be unfair that big companies had a lot more power than regular people, that government has a lot more power than the people it's supposed to be representing. And to the extent that the gifts that I have, you know, to the extent I have gifts, can be used to, even if on a small scale, remedy that, I want to do that. And I do think that it's important that regular people just aren't totally bulldozed by these big corporations.
And so if we really want to get to know where that comes from, that competitiveness and that drive and that feeling that unfairness is going to irk you and kind of be underneath the motivation. What do you think it was when you were growing up that drove that?
Probably, in looking in retrospect, maybe a misplaced feeling that life wasn't fair to me. You know, I wasn't the popular kid. I wasn't a good athlete. I was very uncoordinated. When I was younger, it was undiagnosed, but I had a 90% hearing loss. And then I was told, my mother was told, they didn't tell me yet, because of the hearing loss, I wasn't understanding what they were saying. I had a speech impediment. And then because of the coordination issues, I had unreadable handwriting. And so in first grade, I went to a school called Episcopal Day School, which in Brownsville, Texas was the premier school. And they told my parents that I was not Episcopal Day School material, and that I would not be welcome back. And luckily, you know, I got some good medical care. It was real simple. I just had to have like tubes in my ears to get the fluid drained out and get some, like adenoids out to restore my hearing. A lot of physical therapy, a lot of speech therapy.
A lot of people have, I think, in their backgrounds, those moments of, you know, feeling different and other, and you've been able to turn that and use it to find the connections in your clients. How far deep do you dig when you are representing a client in trial?
Yeah, well, I think those feelings are universal. I think all of us have had a journey. And I think that's been one of the big things for me in my own personal growth is realizing that, you know, while my life hasn't been perfect, neither is anyone else's, and that everyone has struggles, but also everybody has the potential to overcome the struggles. I really do believe that. And more, I believe that, you know, we need to believe in our clients and their potential to overcome their obstacles. So I do believe that the only way to share that potential story of hope and redemption, which I think motivates jurors, is to really get to know people. And I think to get to know people, you have to spend time with them. You have to go to their homes. You have to meet their families. And so if I'm going to try a case, if the client will let me, I do like to do all that. Now, some clients don't want that, and I respect that. But 90% of the time, you know, I go to their homes, I meet their families, I meet their friends, and try to get a real picture for not just what their loss is, but like, what is hope for the future? How can this case, either through the money or just sometimes just through the verdict and knowing that your community cares about you, help this client overcome what they're going through?
So I want to go back, Michael. You talked about how, you know, I do think that your competitiveness and your drive is motivated by something deep-seated. Have you always been okay going there and analyzing where that comes from? Or was there ever a time in your life, in your career, where you didn't want to go there? And because I do think it takes a lot for someone to say, okay, I've got to come to terms with why I think the way I do and where it comes from. Were you always so willing to go back to that kid who had 90% hearing loss and felt that they weren't being treated fairly?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. When I started, in fact, I think it's interesting because I went to the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College in 1998 as a very young lawyer. It was one of the selling points when I was leaving big law and going to decide whether to do insurance defense or whether to do personal injury. The personal injury lawyer that was recruiting me said he'd get me into the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College. And that was actually the factor that pushed it over the edge, because I really wanted to learn to be a great trial lawyer, and I thought that would be a great opportunity. But part of what you do in the Spence College is to do something called psychodrama, where you go in there and you dig deep and you reenact things. And people ask me, like, do you think it was a good thing that you went that early in your career? I'd only tried a few cases at that point. And from the trial skills, I think it was great because I learned a lot about how to try cases. I learned a method. But I was not, like, I participated in psychodrama, but I had a lot of self-editing, a lot of holding back. I was not ready to share a lot of things with other people at that point in my life. And I think It was 3 or 4 years later, I think. It was at a grad program where I did a psychodrama on my relationship with my father, which before that had been very contentious. We get along well now, but very, very contentious. Lots of, I just leave it at that. Just not a good relationship. And was able to not just fully explore that, but also reverse roles and explore where he was during some of the worst moments of my life and maybe
forgive.
Yeah. Or at least understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that to be a good trial lawyer and to be able to tell the story of our clients, we have to get to a point in our own emotional development where we can do that?
I think if you want to try cases the way I want to try cases, yes. I think if you want to try cases where you're going to try to find the emotional truth of a case and you're going to try the case based on love and not anger, then absolutely. I also think you can be totally divorced from all your own emotions and be just like a rabble rouser and get the jury. If you have cases with bad conduct on their side and you can just get the jurors all worked up and angry, I think you can be a horrible person that's not in touch at all with your emotions and who doesn't care about your clients and still get big verdicts. So I'm not saying this is the only way. I know lawyers that are, you know, they have huge egos. They don't want to do the personal work. They don't spend much time with their clients and they get great results, and good for them. You know, this is not the work I've done it's made me happier in the long run, but it's not been easy work. And, you know, I don't begrudge somebody for doing it a different way.
Well, one of the things that I think is, you know, one of the highlights of my career is, you know, being able to try cases with you where the reality is that we're connecting with not just the jurors, with each other and the judge, because yeah. We can appreciate that everybody, like you said, everybody's got that inner core. And that it was an eye opener for me, because I think philosophically as trial lawyers, we tend to see maybe there's a political division that you want certain jurors or not, or racial division, you want certain jurors or not, or gender division, you want certain jurors or not. And being able to try to find the unity in the story and the thought process and the analysis has been a lot of fun. What is your favorite part? What is your favorite part of trying a case?
Cross-examination, 100%. No doubt about that.
Why?
Because it's you against someone else. You're telling a story, specifically cross-examination of professionals, expert witnesses, well-prepared corporate representatives, where, you know, you have the freedom to really dig in and, you know, do all the work to go tell your story through a sophisticated witness. You know, I think it takes a lot more skill, honestly, to cross-examine a sympathetic witness, mm-hmm. But it's not as fun. Like, you know, like truck drivers in general are nice people that screwed up. And so, you know, you want to do a skill set that allows you to cross-examine in a way that you don't look like a jerk. But when you get to go against the bought and paid for, you know, a paid opinion witness or expert witness or the corporate person that doesn't want to admit anything and plays word games, I just love that.
So tell us how you prepare for those.
Well, I really try to think, it's changed over the years, but I really try to think, what story do I want to tell through this witness? And then how do I tell that story? And really what I'm looking back is, you know, we have a trial story. I want to cast the defendant as the villain in that story. So if I can, you know, through these witnesses, through the experts, the corporate representatives, you know, what are the characteristics of a villain? You want someone powerful, someone intelligent, but to be villainous, they need to be deceptive and immoral. So when they're taking things out of context, when they're saying things that aren't really true, when they don't care that that hurts a plaintiff, they don't care they're going to leave, you know, a widow without justice or an injured person without the ability to work because they care more about the money they're getting paid in the next case. That to me motivates me. But then how do you tell that story without just being a jerk? You can't just say that. And, you know, trusting the jury to get it. I don't know. So what I really do is look at, what is the story? Does that story advance my trial story? And so, you know, with a lot of witnesses, it's the villain, that the company is the villain. Other witnesses, you know, we want to talk about maybe my client's damages, maybe, you know, the truck driver, you know, that the truck driver was a victim too of this company by not being given the instruction, not the knowledge the company had wasn't shared with the driver, and that's why the driver made the mistake. So, you know, that's pretty much it. It's just all storytelling.
So for younger lawyers, cross-examination of a professional can be super intimidating because the reality is we will never know as much as that professional knows. I can study all I want for a trial cross-exam of an engineer, but I didn't go to engineering school.
Yep.
So how do you help younger lawyers let go of that obsession with having to know as much as the witness?
Well, I haven't gotten rid of that obsession personally.
reality is you're never going to know as much as the witness.
I never am, but although I'm...
What are you going to monopolize on?
I may not... And I will tell you that I might not know as much about medicine as a defense medical expert, but I may know as much about this one little teeny tiny part of medicine where I've read every paper because I'm obsessive. And so, you know, I think generally for, you know, until you get to a certain level, yeah, don't get in the mud with the expert. Like, don't go fight them on engineering or in medicine, but look at the, you know, what are the things that a jury can't understand? They're paid by the other side, you know, that they have a bias, that they have a motive, where they haven't looked at things, there's things they haven't considered, where they've taken things out of context, where they've ignored evidence.
I love it when we catch them when they rely on papers they themselves didn't read.
Right.
I mean, that's always fun.
The paper says the opposite. I mean, one of my favorite ones is we had a rear end collision without a whole lot of property damage, but my client's seat broke. And they hired someone, a former Honda crash test engineer, who said, there's no way that seat could have broken. There was not enough force to collapse the seat. And one of the papers they did, it was by Biodynamics Research Corporation. When we read the fine print, it said there was no damage at all to the bumper. I mean, we had more damage in our case than they had in the paper. And it said in the paper, and the seats were reinforced with steel to keep them from collapsing. So,
wow.
You know, a jury might not understand delta V and this and that, but when they said they did understand when this guy said a seat couldn't collapse, but they had to reinforce them in the study with steel to keep them collapsing, that the seat could break.
I mean, I think there's a saying that nobody cares more about your case than you do. And that's true even when it's a defense paid witness. I mean, they're not looking at the details the way that you're looking at them.
They're not. And oftentimes they don't read all the medical records. They have someone else summarize the medical records. Or they only look at the typewritten portions and not the handwritten portions. There's all sorts of things that if you just work harder, and I admit, I will jump in there on the medicine sometimes or on the engineering with them if I feel really strongly about it. And if it's a point I think I can make, at a point I think I could survive if I don't.
Tell us the story about the facet joints,
right.
Cross-examination in the recent trial we had. I mean, I think that was one point that the defense paid doctor had to concede to you that you had the medicine right.
Yeah. So basically, we had a client, a case you and I tried this last March. We had a client that had a lot of pre-existing degeneration in her spine, and you could see it. She had like an MRI from like 10 years before. It had all these disc issues, but she didn't have a lot of symptoms before the crash, but before the fall. This one was a fall, not a crash. And she had, so there's different parts of the spine that can cause pain. One is you can have a herniated disc that can cause pain, but then you have an injury to something called a facet joint, and the facet joint can also cause pain. And the way you find out whether the facet joint is causing pain is you numb the nerve coming out of the facet joint. You know, the pain goes away and then comes back when the numbing wears off. Then you know that is facet pain. And then you can do something called a radio frequency ablation where you burn the nerve and the pain goes away for between 9 and 15 months. And in her case, you know, she didn't have a lot of pain before when she had all the discs, which didn't look that much worse afterwards. Then she had a bunch of pain afterwards, but then the pain went away when they did the injection and the radio frequency ablation, and then came back as you would expect it when the ablation started wearing off. And so I got the doctor to admit that if it was the disc pain, it would have been there all before, and it wasn't really there before. And that if the pain went away with the radio frequency ablation, and then, you know, that it would be more likely not facet pain. And he agreed. And I said, well, no one ever said she had a facet injury before this. Would you agree with that? Yes. So more likely than not, the facet injury is from the fall. And he agreed. At that point, though, him agreeing was icing on the cake because the jury gets it at that point.
Right. Right. Well, I was there when that happened in the courtroom, and I could tell that was not prepared. If that was just you're digging into your experience in the medicine.
That was in the moment.
That was in the moment.
Yeah.
And that was fun. It was fun to watch.
But it was also survivable. The guy came up with something else. We still had, well, she only had 3 visits for back pain the 5 years before. And then we had the next one. You know, I was saving the next one for, you know, when he was saying one visit was evidence of back pain from the spine. And it said she has pain when back pain with ovulating that goes away when she has her cycle. And we had, you know, mostly women on the jury. And you're going to tell me that's from a disc. I mean, go for it.
Well, that's definitely part of making sure that the witness is part of the story is we were making sure that the jurors were engaged at that point. Now, when you were talking about, you know, the last thing you ever thought you wanted to be was a personal injury lawyer.
Yeah.
And you talked about your early experiences. What do you love now about the practice?
What I love the most, and maybe I shouldn't say this because I should say my clients, right? Because I do love my clients. I do love helping people. There's 2 things I love the most. What I love most about being a personal injury lawyer is the art. I love putting a story together. I love coming up with a creative visual. I love coming up with an angle that someone else didn't see because it makes me feel smart. Maybe I shouldn't be that way, but I am. So really it's the art of like putting together the perfect case, getting the briefing right. And I really, really, really love, it's not the most profitable way to do business, but I really love finding a way to win a hard case. Finding a way to win a case that someone else told me I couldn't win. I love that. I love going to trial when there's like hardly any offer. Everyone thinks we're going to lose. I love that.
And as your law partner, it's my job, I feel, to try to discourage you from taking those.
Oh, yeah. No, they're not good economics, but I get off on it. I mean, I totally love. But even like, you know, making a $1 million case into a $5 million case or a $100,000 case into a $150,000 case, like finding that little nugget somewhere, I get a dopamine hit from it. It's as good as any drug. The other thing that I love, and this isn't really limited to personal injury law, but it's the reason I have a law firm, is I love watching other people develop. You know, to the extent, and they have to do the work. I mean, you know, like people say, oh, Mallory's so lucky to have you. Well, Mallory did all the work. I just gave her the space to do the work. But I love watching, I love watching you blossom. I watch, you know, you were already pretty good, but I've seen you get better. And, you know, we have some younger lawyers and, you know, it'd probably make more economic sense to hire people 5-10 years out instead of hiring these baby lawyers. But when you see someone come in and you see them struggle and learn and get better and not just growing into their legal skills, but getting the confidence as a person that comes with that and just growing into themselves, it just makes me happy. It's like being a dad.
Now,
I think that's why we do this.
Because
I love sharing
it. I do love the art. I do love the art of practicing law. And I think I love the way you say that because it's true. If you're doing it right, it's an art. I always used to say it's the practice. It is practice because every case is a little different. We're just practicing. But I love the art of practicing law and making the case. Could you, when you were handling smaller cases and in larger volume, is it still an art? Is it an art?
Yes, absolutely. You don't have as much time to devote to it. And frankly, you don't have as much return on the investment. But still, all the medicine I learned was from getting in there and mixing up the courtroom on, you know, soft tissue cases. It was, you know, looking back through my career, I think when I got a $90-something thousand verdict on $3,000 in Cairo bills and no medical treatment for 2 years on a minor rear end collision against, you know, a teacher from a client who could only get his brother to come testify for him, I am more proud of that verdict than any other verdict because that was hard to get. It's not the biggest number. It's not going on my website, but it was a lot easier to get $17.5 million when someone lost part of their leg, even though the liability was tough. But I had a corporation on the other side. I had knowledge of danger. I had a really bad injury to a really nice person. You know, when you're trying those cases that, you know, you don't have as much time to prepare, you have to be creative. You have to be in the moment. You have to really learn your medicine because you're not taking a ton of depositions. I think those are the cases that really make you a lawyer.
And if we're, you know, sharing with other lawyers what do's and don'ts they might consider, you know, in their practices? If you could go back right now to, let's say, you, Michael Cowan, 6 years in to law school, what do you wish you knew then?
You know, I try really hard not to think about this because, you know, every day, God or the universe, depending on what you believe, I believe God gives me so much energy and I hate wasting it on things that I can't, but I still slip and think about, you know, when I was 3 years out, I just went with it. And I think it's because I had a really bad case of codependency, or I hadn't gone through all the therapy to get past that, and took over this mess of a law firm. And on one hand, it served me because I tried a bunch of cases. We had a bunch of crappy cases that had to get tried, almost went broke. But I also developed a lot of bad habits, a lot of doing things at the last minute, never having time, way too much volume. I really think if I had to do it again, I would have tried to find another, just said, look, I'm a baby lawyer. I'm not taking over your practice. If you want to quit, that's your problem. And I would have found a job with a more prominent trial lawyer, because I spent 2 years, 06 to 08, working for a guy named Rob Ammons, incredible lawyer. Just because I'd gotten my practice to a point where I couldn't afford to keep doing it. That was the bad management and bad deals I had made with people. And working for Rob, seeing how someone else ran a practice in a more effective, efficient way, seeing how someone worked up bigger cases, it was really life-changing for me, career-changing for me. And I think if I had worked for someone like Rob Ammons, or you know, if I'd got a job for like a David Perry or a Guy Allison, or you know, one of the great South Texas lawyers, or gone to Houston or Dallas and, you know, try to get a job with one of the great lawyers, I think I probably would have had a head start on the bigger cases, although I wouldn't have had all the trial experience. So it's
right.
You know, can't change it. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. But I would definitely, if somebody was asking for my advice, I would say find someone to mentor you instead of trying to figure it all out on your own.
And so you've told us what you would say no to if you could go back and talk to the younger baby lawyer, Mike McCowan. Is there anything that you would have said yes to? That you, looking back, you think, I should have probably taken that opportunity and I didn't.
That's a very good question. I'm struggling with that one.
Maybe it's because you just say yes to everything.
I think my problem was not, my problem was, you know, learning to say no was my problem. Not saying I took all these bad cases. I took, you know, that, yeah, maybe yes to a job offer. that may have been it.
So how do lawyers, how can you know? Did you know when you were in the cycle of bad habits and doing things that you shouldn't have done and taking cases you shouldn't have taken and making, you know, economic risks that you probably shouldn't have taken? How did you know in that moment that that's what you were doing, or did it take years to go back and look?
I didn't. And I somehow had like a guilt about making a lot of money. And I think I self-sabotaged myself. I don't know if it was a lack of self-worth or this was an art and we're supposed to be pure and try to help everybody. And so, you know, I would cut my fees all the time too. So I was constantly cutting my fees, making bad deals, taking, like investing huge amounts of money in cases that weren't good cases, and then trying to, you know, get something out of them. So I think that problem was a me problem. It wasn't, but I don't think until I did the personal work to get past the issues of codependency that came from my childhood, where I could see that I had worth and see that I could say no to things. I mean, I think one of the things you bought me earlier in career was the red button that says no, because you have helped me immensely on that path and made my life better. But it took, you know, I did not see it. I was in the middle of it. I was doing irrational things. I was not taking care of myself. When you're in it, you don't see it.
And so, you know, you've talked a little bit about getting therapy, surrounding yourself with people who want to see you succeed. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do to get out of a cycle like that. What do you attribute it to?
It's not in getting the right therapy, because, I mean, I think if you get, you know, I have a psychology degree, and most of us in that program were screwed up people trying to figure out what was wrong with us. And so just because someone's a therapist doesn't mean that they're not totally a mess themselves. Mm. And so if therapy is just talking about how messed up you are and blaming other people for it, it's not helpful at all. And I think I know people that I think therapy made them worse. If you're doing like a cognitive behavioral therapy where you're trying to say, I want some understanding of myself so that I can move forward and change my life and make it better. And I'm going to get actionable ways to restructure how I view things so that I can, you know, get out of suffering and get into achievement. Then I think that is helpful. And my first couple people I talked to were not particularly helpful, but then I accidentally found a really good one. And I did not see her for, I didn't want weight loss surgery, but I was talking to a weight loss doctor that did a non-surgical weight loss practice. And they referred me to see a psychologist to help me with weight issues. And that's actually who turned me onto this other journey. It took a long time for the weight part to really work, but really turned me onto this journey of self-improvement. Cause she actually gives me actionable things and has helped me kind of reframe the way I see the world.
So one thing that I think is true for organizations is that change can be hard. So how do you manage a practice where you've got people working for you, office managers, staff, support people, and you are making major changes in yourself, recalibrating how you're going to think and act? How nimble does your team have to be in your practice when that's coming? Does that happen easily?
It does it. And sometimes your team that liked working with you when you're dysfunctional will not like working with you when you're functional, or you won't like working with them.
What do you mean? Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, when I had a chaotic life and a chaotic mind, the people I worked with were, a lot of them were similarly dysfunctional and similarly chaotic. And we all kind of would whine together about how unfair life was, be perfectly honest. And when I stopped engaging in that, and, you know, when I want to give someone like some coaching, instead of saying, oh, yeah, life sucks, and mind by saying, yeah, that does suck, but so what? What do you do about it? We still have to, you know, something horrible happened 20 years ago. Well, are you going to give that power over the rest of your life, or are you going to change things? And, you know, they're not going to like that. And when you start running things differently, you end up finding your people, and you unfortunately lose some people.
Is it really necessary? Is it really necessary for you to make change in yourself and then change in the organizations that you're connected to?
Well, if you're happy where you are, then you don't need to change anything. If you want to, if you're at a firm and the firm is not supporting where you want to be, either work-life balance, either culture, emotion, then you either need to change the firm or you need to change where you work. You can't. And if I'm heading a firm and my firm is, you know, when a lot of it's just getting rid of the fantasy of what I want it to be and realizing what it really is and realizing, okay, we're doing a lot of good stuff, but we're also dysfunctional in other areas. Then you have to confront that, give people opportunities to grow with you. And if they're not willing to do that, usually they'll self-select and go somewhere else. But I think the Cy Wakeman has a great saying, as she's used to be a therapist, now does business consulting. It's like, stay in joy or leave in peace. It's like, this is what we're doing. And we'd love for you to join us on this. But if not, there's a place for you. And I'll be honest, there's some lawyers that worked at our firm that didn't really like the way we do things. And they're fabulously successful somewhere else. They're great lawyers and they're great human beings. And I love them when I see them. We just weren't the right fit, you know? And it's like any other human relationship. I mean, there's lots of great people out there that, you know, let's say if I wasn't married, they might be wonderful people, but I wouldn't want to date them, or they wouldn't want to date me because we're not the right fit. I think the same goes for friendships, same goes for work. And there's, you know, friends that I want to spend a lot of time with, and there's people that I'd like to, you know, run into once or twice a year and be very friendly, but not spend every day with. And I think work's the same way.
So one thing, talking about work and talking about our practices, one thing that I get asked a lot is what is going on at our firm? We've got a lot of women lawyers who work here. And the reality is that in the litigation arena, women are a very small part of the practice. And in the plaintiff's personal injury arena, it's even smaller. And then the trucking practice, it's not very many women. So for you to have as many women at your firm as we do, it says something. I don't know what, but it does say something about our practice and our culture. What do you think it is?
You know, I've thought about that too. I think part of it is really, really important to me to have a world with fairness and equality. And I think I have tried very hard to have a culture where whether you're a man or a woman, that you feel supported, you don't feel any less than, you feel that you have opportunities, that you're treated fairly, you're not paid any more or any less. And so I think part of it just may be I get along better with women than men. I don't know. I mean, we have a couple of male lawyers. I like them a lot, but maybe I have some trauma from some bad deals with some male partners I've had. I don't know.
Maybe so.
But I seem to get along better with women than men, although we do have a couple of male lawyers, and I'm hoping that they succeed. And, I don't want to be, all women, but, we were a lot less functional when we were all male. I mean, I'd be out of town working and they'd all be at a bar. And now at least y'all are drinking wine. It's more respectable.
Well, it has been fun practicing, I think, with the lawyers that we've assembled here. Talk to us a little bit about not just love in the art of the practice, but loving the practice, loving who you work with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one thing that keeps me going is, I've done the math. I would make more money at least this year and next year if I just did big cases with a really small team and hardly any overhead. I think I lose money out of my pocket, at least for the short term, unless I could really learn how to run a business. And we have a new COO, and I hope that's going to change. But for the last 3 or 4 years, for the next 2 or 3 years, I would make more money if I just scaled down and said, I'm going to be a huge case litigation boutique. You, Mallory, and I, and maybe an associate are just going to, take 10 or 15 cases, one or two paralegals, and just keep a lot of money. But I really love the people I work with. I love our community. I love watching, and maybe that's why we attract so many women. It's because I love watching women who maybe feel, whether it's right or wrong, because I don't want to accuse other law firms of not giving women opportunities, but maybe they don't realize they have an opportunity there. Maybe they don't realize that it's safe to ask to do things. But I have a place where I can see people develop, and I make enough money anyway. So, I would rather have that. So I do love the people I work with. I like hanging out with you. I love watching y'all grow. I love collaborating. And I love what I've learned from y'all. I mean, that's the other thing. And y'all have made me a better lawyer and a better person.
And, one of the mantras at our firm is that we learn and we share what we learn. Oh, now, I have heard that there are firms out there that don't share as freely as our firm does. I mean, we were always happy to share our forms and depots and outlines and things like that. Why is that such a big deal to you?
Karma. I am here today because other great lawyers shared with me. 20-something years ago, I'm getting my first F-150 rollover roof crush case. And Michael Watts had just gotten a big verdict on an F-150 rollover roof crush case. And he tells his staff, he doesn't know me. He tells the staff to let me go to their office and go through all their trial exhibits and trial transcript so I could get the best exhibits to use, go through the discovery. I mean, it's just incredible. He didn't have to do that. He didn't know me. I'm in trial in March, and at one point in the trial, we had a high-low agreement in place, and I had a certain ask. I wanted to know if I should change my ask because, why ask for as much if I have a high-low? And so Joe Freed picks up the phone and he talks me through the issues. Just people do it for me. I need to do it for other people.
I think that's really important, especially in our practice where we represent plaintiffs. And I think it goes a long way to where you started originally, that you really want the little guy the injured person to have the same representation as the major corporations. And that only works if we're sharing information, right?
Yep. And I don't like the word the little guy, though.
I know.
And because I think that our people are not little people. I think they have the same worth and the same capacity, whether they realize it or not, as the CEO of the biggest corporations. And I think that we should never... I just think we, over the years, I've learned to really respect my clients and seen the resiliency of my clients. It's actually taken a lot of pressure off at trial. Because, like, if a trial doesn't go well, they're going to find a way to survive. They're going to make it. And if it does go well, they're going to figure out what to do. And if you get them a bunch of money and they blow it, they're going to find a way to survive. Now, you give them good advice. You don't want that to happen. But respecting the resiliency of our clients and that there are whole, complete human beings. They're not broken. They're not powerless. They need help, and we're here to help them. But also, I want to see my client as big and as great. You know, our little widow that we talk to, I say little because she's tiny, not because who doesn't speak English, who's a recent immigrant whose husband was just killed. I want to give her the same dignity and respect that I would give the CEO of a major corporation when we were Lehman Brothers trial counsel.
Right. Well, you forget I'm 5 feet tall, so... The word little, it's never pejorative to me. It's literal.
Yeah, but I don't see you as anything but fierce and capable.
Well, thanks, Michael. This has been a fun talk. I hope our listeners have found it enjoyable, too, and we kind of get to pull the curtain back a little bit and learn a little bit about you.
Well, thank you. It's kind of awkward talking about myself. I'm used to interviewing other people, but... it's been a little more emotional than I thought it would be, but I do appreciate the opportunity. And thank you for the people that suggested this. And thank you to Sonia. And please, everyone, join us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive, plaintiff lawyer-only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.